is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast. I'm Buster Olney. I'm working from my home in Montana. Sean Bartley is working from his home in L.A. How you doing, Sean?
I'm doing pretty good this morning, Buster. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Headed to Texas later today to start to prep for our season opener, Cubs versus Rangers on Thursday night. But first, we have this really cool announcement of this thing that's happening with the podcast on Wednesday. And for that, we bring in Taylor Schwenk for a cameo. Taylor, take it away.
Hello, Buster. Hello, Sean. It's good to see your beautiful faces again. It's been too long.
What's up?
Sean, first of all, before we do anything else, I gotta give a round of applause for Sean. Keeping the ship together, the train's running on time. You know, it's a big task. This is a big job. You could really just do this for 40 hours a week. And I know neither one of us do that. And he did a commendable job. I'm very pleased with the work he's done. And he's come a long way. He's grown up so much over these last 5 weeks. But the big news here, gentlemen, is we are going to be on television.
Nice.
Wednesday, ESPN2, 2 p.m. Eastern time, a quote-unquote season preview episode. We tried to keep it, you know, a little bit broader. Everyone's bringing bold predictions. We're hoping to have some special guests on. It's a lot of fun. We've got some of it in the can already. This is a huge opportunity for us, and we're super excited.
Yeah, Jeff Passan's going to join us. We're going to have Jake Peavy. Kevin Pillard's going to join us. Hembo, Sarah Langs. We got a full cast. And as you say, we're hoping for a surprise guest that we're working on as we speak. So very fired up about that. Thanks for jumping in, Taylor. You're coming off paternity leave to join us.
Yeah, man, it's been 5 weeks since I worked last. And I got to give credit to our boss, Andrew Hahn, who called me with the news of the TV show and was like, I figured you might murder me if I didn't tell you about this and get you involved. So he was correct. Maybe not murder. That would have been strong, but I would have been upset. So I'm glad I'm in the mix. I'm glad that we've got this all sorted out. And out of all the things we've done on the podcast through these last 5 years, Buster, this is season 5 for the two of us, by the way, which is incredible. But Wow. This might be the biggest thing we've ever done. So please watch. Please tell your friends to watch. You know, this is probably just a one-off, but you never know what the future holds.
On ESPN2, what were you saying? What time?
2 p.m. Eastern. ESPN2, 2 p.m. Eastern. If you're looking at it on your DVR, it'll probably say the low post. That's normally when they run that. But yeah, set your DVR or watch it live. We're very excited about this.
Yep, absolutely. All right. Since the last podcast, MLB announced it will investigate the Shohei Ohtani matter, in which his former personal interpreter is accused of, quote unquote, massive theft by legal representatives of Ohtani. Ohtani spoke with the media in L.A. on Monday evening.
So I never bet on baseball or any other sports, or never have asked somebody to do it on my behalf. And I have never went through a bookmaker to bet on sports.
Since the last podcast, the Orioles decided to send Jackson Holliday to the minor leagues. Kind of a shocking move. Taylor, look, we're going to explore this fully, I know, on Wednesday's pod. You want to just jump in with a one-word reaction to this decision?
I'll do two. Not surprised.
Okay. Well, Tim Kirkjian and I are going to talk about that, and also about the legacy of Peter Angelos, the longtime Orioles owner who passed away over the weekend. Miles Straw, center fielder for the Cleveland Guardians, was outrighted in the minor leagues. He's still owed about $20 million on his contract. The Brewers right-hander Brandon Woodruff told reporters he will not pitch this year. He's targeting a return to in 2025 after having major shoulder surgery. Matt Strom got an extension from the Philadelphia Phillies that runs through the 2025 season, also contains an option for 2026. The Phillies traded outfielder Jake Cave to the Colorado Rockies, hoping Jake gets a chance to play there, one of the good guys in baseball. J.D. Martinez came off the board, signed with the New York Mets, 1 year, $13 million. He told reporters he just absolutely lives for the postseason. Tim Kirkjian's got some thoughts on this signing. And big news for the Colorado Rockies, Ezekiel Tovar, their young shortstop, signed a $63.5 million deal over seven guaranteed seasons. There's also a club option on that contract. Sean, what else you got?
Wanted to tell everybody, go check out the College Game Day podcast. Adrian has really been holding it down, juggling two shows. We've been focusing on the basketball tournament and then as well as any of the latest college football news that comes down. So be sure to check that out wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.
Seam heads rejoice. This is Timmy time.
Baseball is the greatest game.
With Tim Kirkson.
It never disappoints you.
On Baseball Tonight.
Tim Kirkson covers baseball for ESPN. And Tim, I saw on social media today, you got a dream coming true. Pretty cool.
Yeah. My son Jeff and I are going to do a father-son baseball podcast starting March 28th, opening day. It's going to be once a week. It's going to be every Tuesday. It's going to be just a father and a son, something I've always wanted to do with my son. He's in the radio business in Philadelphia, music talk, country music talk every morning. And he's been bugging me about this for years. It's something I've always wanted to do. So we're going after it. And I sent it out on Twitter this morning. And of course, he had to set up the whole thing on my phone. So all I had to do was press a button because I wouldn't know how to send out something like that on Twitter otherwise. That's how bad I am, but that's how good he is at all the technology.
Nice. Yeah, well, I saw there was a video attached, and I was like, that is not Tim's speed with social media. But you attached a video there.
I can barely use my phone as a phone, let alone a Twitter device, let alone adding video. So Jeffrey took care of everything, said, Dad, just wake up on Monday morning and press the post button, and you'll be set.
All right. A lot of news happened over the weekend, and we'll start with this. Peter Angelos, the longtime owner of the Baltimore Orioles, passed away. He has a fascinating legacy in baseball. Tell me about, Peter and your experience with him.
Yeah, I had a really good relationship with Peter Angelos, and I'm not sure many people in the media can say that, and I don't know if that's good or bad, but I was able to connect with him early on in that process. I wrote a story for Sports Illustrated when he bought the club, and I learned an awful lot about him, what a self-made man he was. I know how brilliant he is, and I'm really sad that he's gone because he was very helpful to me. But he was different, Buster. He was a tough, tough guy. I once remember telling him, I said, Peter, you know, little guys like you and me. And he looked at me and he goes, little guy. He goes, I weigh 185 pounds. I wear a 44 coat. I am not a little guy. And I went, whoa. I had to rephrase, Peter, little guys like me. So I'm not sure what that meant. I just know you better be ready.
Oh, you know what it meant. You know what it meant. He was combative.
I know exactly what it meant. You better be ready for a fight if you go after Peter Angelos, because he is going to try to beat you no matter what. And I always kind of admired him for that.
I did, too. I actually got to know him really well. Talked on most days, not only in the 2 years I covered the Orioles, but, you know, for years after I left the beat. As you know, you would place a call with his secretary, and sometimes you'd be put on hold and you'd wait. And what I found later in conversation with his former general manager, Pat Gillick, is that we as reporters had more access to him than his general managers. The general managers would be sitting out in the lobby, and meanwhile, he's having conversations with us on the phone. The guy, you know, put himself through law school. He became one of the most successful plaintiff lawyers in the history of the United States. You know, bought the Orioles. He loved Baltimore. Like, he loved the city of Baltimore, Tim. I think you'd agree with me on that.
Yeah, and it's really a shame that obviously they didn't win at all while he was there. But he kept the team there. And even though the team was pretty bad for portions of his ownership, they're still the Orioles, and they're still going strong now. They're in a great position, and someday they're going to win the World Series, and unfortunately, he's not going to be around to see it. But he did a lot for baseball in Baltimore, and I know a lot of people don't like him. I totally understand that. He's an abrasive personality, but he cared about his hometown, and he really cared about Baltimore and baseball in Baltimore.
You talked about the toughness. You know, when we would talk, and I was at the Baltimore Sun, Ken Rosenthal was a primary columnist, and he hated Kenny. Like, he hated him with a passion. And I would call him because it was important to maintain that relationship. And I swear to you, Tim, that the first 10 minutes of most days started with him cussing me out. Just saying, you MFers at the Sun, how can you? And he would, can you believe what that so-and-so Ken Rosenthal wrote? What do you think? And I'd say, well, you know, Peter, it's not for me to say. If you want me to pass something on to Kenny, because they didn't have a talking, they weren't, you know, in communication, I said I'd be happy to. Yeah, but what do you think? And I'm like, that's not really for me to say, Peter. But if you got something to say to our paper, I think you have the right to, you know, tell me and I'll pass it up the line. And he would wear himself out and then he would like catch his breath. This happened every time. And he goes, you know, I don't know why I'm yelling at you. You didn't write the article. And then we'd have great conversations. And I tell people all the time, and I sent this out on Twitter, and for some reason it was translated by some people as a, you know, deep criticism of him. I think what made him great as a lawyer became his weakness as an owner. And that what made him great as an owner was he didn't trust anybody. Like, he was not someone who easily trusted people. And then in baseball, when you had someone like Pat Gillick, he ignored the advice of really smart baseball people. And I think in the long run, as much as he wanted to win, and Tim, you know, like I do, he wanted to win. In the end, that probably became a problem for him, that he didn't trust people.
Yeah, I totally agree. When Buck Showalter came along, though, he recognized that Buck is taking care of every minute detail. And I think maybe the only guy he really, truly trusted during that time was Buck, because Buck was the first guy there, slept in the clubhouse. But to not trust Davey Johnson or Pat Gillick during those great years when they had those great teams, that was something against Peter Angelos, certainly. And as for Ken Rosenthal, look, he's our dear friend, Buster, and he's one of the greatest baseball writers / reporters in the history of baseball, period. But Peter was so angry at him once, he called him an insolent twit in the newspaper one day. And Junior, of course, took it as a compliment because he knew that he had gotten under Peter Angelos' skin. So Ken Rosenthal was fearless when it came to the owner, but the owner was fearless when it came to everyone.
Oh, yeah. And he would say, you know, I had to yank all your credentials. And then he'd go, no, I can't do that. I get three free pages of advertising of the Baltimore Sun every day. Right. he was a smart guy. And, you know, rest in peace, Peter Angelos. As they say, he's got a complicated legacy in baseball. One thing I would say, people should remember that when the strike occurred, the player strike occurred in 1994-95, Peter really blew up the owner strategy by refusing to field a team of replacement players. And I think that created a real problem for the owners.
Right. Well, again, Peter Angelos was not afraid to stand up to anybody about anything. And that will be part of his amazing legacy.
You know, the Orioles are in the news for making a decision about Jackson Holliday, sending him to the minor leagues. Mike Elias, head of baseball operations for that team, talked about, you know, needing more experience against left-handed hitting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Tim, come on. You know, you talk about a small sample size. So he's going to go down the minor league, start the year there, and getting an extra 25 or 30 plate appearances against left-handed hitting or pitching, that's going to make a difference. Are we back to the time when we're manipulating service time?
Yeah, I'm not buying it, Buster. A couple doubles, couple triples, three homers, a bunch of RBIs. I know he struck out, you know, every three at bats, but look, he should be on the everyday roster. He should be the primary second baseman to open the season. Imagine the excitement in that place, which is going to be wild anyway, but imagine you start a season with Holliday and Gunnar Henderson as your double play combination, especially with new ownership coming in. Look, I understand to some degree the roster and the, you know, service time manipulation. But when you have a chance to win, you don't worry about service time. You go after it right away. And he is one of the 26 best players on the team. He should be there opening day.
Yeah, I hope that the incoming ownership, you know, they have a conversation with Mike Elias and basically tell him, you know what, don't worry about that. Let's bring him up to the big leagues. Because, Tim, what you're basically telling your players, the message that the players are going to hear from this is that the front office doesn't care about winning as much as the players do. That's a real problem. We saw that, you know, with the Chicago Cubs. I think all of that stuff, the whole thing with Chris Bryant, wound up affecting the relationship between the Cubs and some of their position players in the end.
Right.
What do you think?
And Buster, it shouldn't be this way, but when the players are in the clubhouse, and you and I have seen this 1,000 times, when they're in the clubhouse saying, guys upstairs don't care about us down here, they don't play exactly the same way. And that doesn't mean the Orioles don't care. Mike Elias has done a fabulous job now putting this team together. But you got to play your best players, and Jackson Holliday is the best second baseman on their team right now.
A couple people over the weekend reporting, I think Bob Nightingale was one of them, that Jordan Montgomery is close to making a decision. I assume that he's going to sign after the first pitch is thrown on opening day, so he's detached from draft pick compensation. For me, Tim, the team that should be signing him, without a doubt, the Boston Red Sox. They've got the payroll flexibility. If they move past the draft pick compensation, I think that would help it make it more palatable. I've had agents estimate to me that Jordan Montgomery was, you know, being talked about as maybe, you know, getting a deal in the Aaron Nola range when this offseason began. I've had agents tell me that, look, if he gets a Taiwan Walker deal, 4 for 70, 72, he's going to be great. What do you think?
He needs to sign, and he needs to sign today, although I agree with you, he's probably going to wait till the end of the week to do this. Jim Bowden, our friend, reported that multiple teams have a multi-year contract out there, not just a two-year deal with an opt-out like Blake Snell. So let's – and you're right, the Red Sox are not going to make the playoffs even with Jordan Montgomery. But you have to send a message to that fan base and that team that we are really trying to win. And that is the opposite of the way it's being presented by Red Sox ownership at this point. They need him to start opening day. And Buster, I told you 10 times what a great look I got at him during the postseason. I was around that team all the time. He is a wildly competitive guy. He's better than people think. And this is the best he's ever thrown. The light has gone on. He is a number one starting pitcher in the major leagues, and he should be that for the Red Sox or several other teams.
What did you think of the Mets signing of J.D. Martinez, 1 year, $13 million?
Well, look, I think it was great because I think J.D. Martinez, first off, had a very productive year last year, and he is one of the great students of hitting that I've ever been around. And he's not, doesn't just do it for himself, you know, watching all of his video, and he just hides out and looks at stuff. He passes information along every single day. Mookie Betts told me he used to go in the clubhouse every day in Boston, and the first guy he would go to was J.D. Martinez. Like, what are we going to see from this pitcher tonight? What should I do if this is the spot? And J.D. Martinez had a lot to do with Mookie Betts becoming a great hitter. And I think he can pass some of that along to the Mets young players who need it. And I think he can hit 30 homers and drive in close to 100 runs again.
All right. I want you to fill in the blank on this question. The Shohei Ohtani story is the weirdest baseball story since blank.
Oh, God.
As we sit here today, look, Major League Baseball is looking into it. There's a lot of information to come. I don't expect to get any answers from anybody within the next 48, 72 hours, but there's no question. This is a weird story.
Yeah, I am so confused by all of this, Buster, and I made a tremendous mistake by going through Twitter and reading what every Yahoo in the world thinks about this, and I just can't do that. You just have to be logical as to what is going to happen. All right, I'm going to try to answer your question. The whole Pete Rose thing, look, I don't want to get into Pete Rose versus Shohei Ohtani. That's not the point, but Pete Rose was the hit king when all of this came up about him. And Ohtani is not Pete Rose on any level, but he's the biggest player in the game. And that's why this is just so mind-boggling to me that here we are 3 days before opening day, and this is what is dominating everything.
All right, give us your World Series pick, Tim. I know you had to turn that in for ESPN.com. Your World Series picks are every year, perennially, the best in the industry. You get every single one right. Every single division you pick right. Every single award you predict correction is right. So give me your World Series pick.
Well, first off, in 1991, NL West, I picked the Twins to finish last and the Angels to finish first in the division. And as it turned out, they were opposite. The Twins finished first and the Angels finished last. So when you talk about predictions, nobody has ever been worse in one year than I was in 1991. To answer your question, I'm going to say the Braves are going to beat the Astros in the World Series with the understanding that I'm going to change my mind tomorrow because something is going to happen tomorrow. That's the beauty of this sport, is one little thing can make everything change. So that's where I am. I had to send it in because we all did. That's what I sent in. And anyone who thinks that I think I'm going to be right about this, or I care if I'm going to be right about this, I don't think so.
Another fill in the blank question. Best player in baseball in 2024 will be?
I'm going to say it's going to be Mookie Betts. I predicted that he will win the MVP in the National League. Of course, it really helped that he drove in six runs in the second game of the season. I'm going to say he's going to win the National League MVP, and he's going to be the best player in the game, in part because he's going to be doing this remarkable production as a shortstop, which gives it extra, extra value.
Yeah, this should worry you. I picked Mookie Betts as well.
No.
So, yes, oh boy. To win MVP. So we were both in trouble, I think.
We're dead. It'll be somebody else for sure now.
All right, Tim. Thanks for doing this.
Okay, Buster. Talk to you soon.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs, reporter, producer for MLB.com. Sarah, how you doing? Beginning of this week and opening day coming up?
I am doing great, Buster. I don't know if we've discussed on here, but I do the New York Times crossword puzzle every single day. My current streak is at 362. It's actually going to hit 365. Like on opening day, I think. And on Monday, the crossword was baseball themed. I won't give it away in case anyone is listening and gets eager to go do it, but I was so excited to see that.
Nice. That, did you finish it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah.
I like Sarah, very, very matter of fact. Oh, yeah. Finished the New York Times crossword puzzle. Sean, have you finished the New York Times crossword puzzle?
I haven't even started one before.
I've tried some and I'm too busy. So yeah, Sarah, way to go with that. I didn't know you had that kind of a streak going. Yeah, 1 year. That's impressive. All right. Before we get started with the numbers game, my question for you is, who's your favorite player from spring training?
Oh my goodness. I mean, there were so many players and it was so much fun to watch. I might have to go with Wyatt Langford for what he did.
Yep. I knew you were going to say that.
I love that. I love that you knew. But I mean, all those home runs he had, I didn't know the other day. Again, spring training is whatever. But not that many guys as young as he is I've hit at least 6 home runs in the single spring training. I don't remember, it was Freddie Freeman and someone else very notable were the only other guys to hit that mark at that age. I mean, he's going to be so much fun to watch. And I just love when a guy has all of this hype around him. The storyline is, will he make the team? And he just comes out and leaves absolutely no doubt. So I had a lot of fun watching him.
All right. So you know Bruce Bochy well, manager of the Texas Rangers. I'm sure you saw the video of him telling Langford that he's going to the big leagues. It was the most anticlimactic conversation in the history of those conversations, Sarah. Would you agree with me? And the way that Boats presented it, like, he's so good. Langford is so good that they would feel stupid to say anything other than, oh, well, of course you're on the team.
I mean, it was so Bochy. I loved it. And you know what I was thinking? I was that nowadays, when a guy makes the team or gets called up, we just expect that we're going to get this video. But I remember the first time I can recall seeing one of these videos was in 2011. The Giants did a show on Showtime, very similar to Hard Knocks for the NFL, where they were followed around all year as reigning champs by camera crews. One of the moments that made the show was Brandon Bell, who had been highly regarded prospect, being told right before the end of spring training that he had made the team by Bruce Bochy, belt search, crying. Bochy says, have a beer, take your time, and just leaves them in the office. Well, I was wondering if Bochy was, I mean, he's done this so many times now, but I was wondering if he was thinking of that moment with Brandon Bell, him breaking down, crying, and how far he's come, and how far they've all come.
Yeah, no kidding. His reaction, I mean, everybody was like, yeah, of course. Yeah, he's that good. He's been a big leaguer, it felt like, since the beginning of spring training, and they were just putting the rubber stamp on that decision to start the year with him. Think about that. He's hitting third in spring training, and he hasn't played a game in the big leagues. Hitting third for the defending champions. That tells you how great he's been. All right, let's play the numbers game.
Number three is 20. So speaking of guys who made their opening day rosters, we have Jackson Chourio for the Milwaukee Brewers, who will be the starting center fielder on opening day. He'll be 20 years and 17 days old. So last week or a few weeks ago, we talked about Jackson Merrill, another Jackson, another center fielder. But Jackson Chourio is even younger. So he will be the third youngest opening day starting center fielder since at least 1901. Third youngest. Basically anything I can search for you. Older than only Tony Conigliaro, 1964, and Ken Griffey Jr. in 1989. Both of them were 19 years old. And if we take away the position qualifier, it would still be the fifth youngest in the divisional era, that goes back to 1969, at any position to start. On opening day, we have Robin Yount on there twice, at 18 in 1974 and 19
wow.
in 1975. You have Griffey, who I mentioned, and Adrian Beltre in 1999.
Number two is 200,
so I put together a big milestone watch for MLB.com over the weekend, and one of the numbers in there is 200 for 200 career home runs for Pete Alonso. Since he debuted, nobody in baseball has more home runs than his 192. He got to 100 home runs in the second fewest games in MLB history. So where will he rank for 200? So he's 8 away. He's played 684 games so far. The fewest games to 200 home runs is 658 by Ryan Howard. Aaron Judge got there in 671. And then Ralph Kiner in 706. And then we have Juan Gonzalez at 766. So depending what kind of start he gets off to, he'll either be in that third or fourth fastest to 200 home runs.
And number one.
Number one is 300. So another New York milestone on the runs to keep an eye on is Aaron Judge. He is 257. So he's not going to get there early in the season. But being 43 away seems very doable for Aaron Judge as long as he stays healthy. So nobody has more home runs than him since 2016 when he debuted. But he debuted in August of that year, which tells you how far ahead of everyone he is. So for him, when we wonder where he might rank in terms of fewest games, he has played 835 games so far. The fewest games to 300 home runs is 1,087. That means that even if Judge does not get to 300 until sometime early next year, he would still be the fastest to get to that mark.
All right, speaking of milestones, last year, JD Martinez hit his 300th career homer. He drove in career RBI number 1,000. He's about 361 hits away from 2,000 his career. In recent days, we heard the Mets signed in 1 year, $13 million deal. What do you think, Sarah? I love it for the Mets.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they have needed that other power hitter to go along with Pete Alonso for so long. And Francisco Lindor is an amazing power hitter for his position. He had that 30-30 season last year. But he doesn't have that same. I mean, they needed a DH, a real DH, an everyday guy who was going to go out there, and you knew he would be at the position. We've seen teams have different approaches since the DH became universal. And I think the Mets acknowledge them. Their sort of piecemeal approach in the first few years of the role and not sort of the mall. I love this for them. And I think it's really, really good. You know, a good sign for their attempts to be competitive in this year that a lot of people have written off.
Yeah, and this is not a knock on Jeff McNeil, but there have been times, as you know, in recent years where he's batting fourth and fifth, and you're just like, oh boy, you know, they need someone with thump. And if you look at the Mets relative to the Braves, relative to the Phillies, the biggest difference is power hitting, home run hitting, and now they get to, at least for 1 year, you know, JD Martinez. Sarah, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
Baseball Tonight, 2024 Team Preview, Kansas City Royals, Machinations.
Like the Cincinnati Reds, the Kansas City Royals executed a small market version of going all in over the winter. They acquired veterans to augment this year's team, signing starting pitchers Michael Wacha, Seth Lugo, and they traded for Kyle Wright. They signed relievers Will Smith, John Schreiber, Nick Anderson. They signed outfielder Hunter Renfroe. And above all else, they locked up Bobby Witt Jr., be the face of the franchise for many years to come.
A guy to watch.
The Royals got lefty Cole Reagans in a midsummer trade for reliever Aroldis Chapman, which has a chance to go down in history as one of the best deals in recent memory. Because Reagans went from being Clark Kent to Superman after he landed at Kansas City. In 12 starts with the Royals last year, at a 2.64 ERA with 89 strikeouts and 71 and two-thirds innings. His average fastball velocity jumped by 4 miles per hour in 2023. As one staffer told Jeff Passan earlier this year, it's like Reagans became a left-handed Jacob DeGrom.
The Foundation.
Bobby Witt Jr. emerged as one of the game's best players. In his last 78 games last season, his games after June 30th, he batted .311 with a .352 on-base percentage and a .576 slugging percentage. And he stole 26 bases. He is a 40-40 candidate in 2024 and the right guy to build around.
Win projection.
Forecasts are pretty consistent. Hembo says 71, and so does Sarah. Hakoda is at 70.4. I'm going rogue. I think the Royals are going to be among the surprise teams in the majors, win 78 games, and flirt with a playoff berth. Joe Goldberg has been working the sidelines in Kansas City Royals television broadcast since 2008. Joel, thanks for joining us.
Buster, good to be with you.
All right, so this is kind of a fun, exciting camp for the Royals this year. We're seeing some of the mid-market, small-market teams taking a step forward, and the Kansas City Royals, who went out and had kind of a small-market version of a spending splurge during the winter. Tell me about the feel in the camp compared to recent years.
You know what I think is different than previous years, Buster, is it's not that there's hope and excitement, because you could find 30 camps that all have that same hope and excitement, whether that is well-placed or misplaced. You know, it's that time of year. I think what's different to me is when I walked into that spring training clubhouse, it looked totally different. I mean, this isn't a matter of two or three different guys. This is a matter of seven, eight, or nine different guys, and not non-roster invitees. Everybody has those players that are looking for that last chance, and everybody does that. But we're talking about seven, eight, nine guys that all have big league contracts that were on different teams last year. And so it suddenly felt like, for lack of a better term, a grown-up room. And I say that not mocking last year, but it was a team full of 22, 23, 24-year-olds just finding their way. Suddenly you look around this clubhouse and it's like, wait a minute, there are a lot of guys that have been here before.
Cole Reagans comes over in a trade last year. It might turn out to be one trade we're talking about for a lot of years to come because of how well he pitched for the Royals after he joined the team. What happened with Cole Reagans after he came to Kansas City?
I think a couple things. I mean, one, I think, was just getting back into a rotation. Texas didn't have a spot for him in that rotation. And look, I would say that all worked out well for Texas short term, at least, because they won a World Series. And whether it was in part because of that or not, nobody should ever argue with the World Series. But now you're looking out. I mean, we're talking about a Cole Reagans here that I think some people have as maybe a dark horse Cy Young Award candidate. And he's the opening day starter here now. I think they made a couple of tweaks, a little bit of change with some grips and adding some pitches. You see that stuff happen all the time. I think the other thing too is that this is a guy that maybe is far enough along now. Maybe this would have happened with Texas, maybe not, post Tommy John surgery. Not one of them, but two of them. And so maybe he's finally in a place where we're talking about his velocity. I mean, he was coming out and threw some triple digits early in spring training, and people were saying, wait a minute, what's going on here? But it's possible that he's stronger and better and in a better place than he's ever been. And he's only 26 years old too. And so, I mean, I think that's what everybody here is excited about. He was the August, I believe, pitcher of the month in the American League last year. And during that stretch, Buster, completely unhittable. He was as good as anybody in the league at that point.
So Bobby Witt Jr. has always been a touted player, you know, obviously a high first round draft pick, but it felt like after June 30th last year, he just took off. What happened with him, do you think?
Just maturing in age. You know, his rookie year wasn't bad. He struggled at times in the field, and the metrics showed that. I could tell you, and he's not the only one. You see it all over the league. He's one of those guys that every time you look up, you know, hours before anyone's in the stadium, he's taking early ground balls with the infield coach. He's doing all the drills. He's one of those guys that just loves baseball and happens to be really good at it. And so I think everything just kind of came together for him. And this isn't a situation where it's like, boy, what took so long? He turned 23 during the season last year in June. And then you look up and the only guy that has that skill set by numbers in the league at a much higher level is Ronald Acuña Jr. I mean, we're talking about in his second season in the big leagues, putting up 30 homers and 49 stolen bases. And you ask him and he would tell you he could do a lot better than that. And so I think the two most significant pieces of this offseason, one was the $100+ million that the Royals spent on the Michael Wachas and the Seth Lugos and Hunter Renfroe and Will Smith and on, and revamping a whole bullpen that has no one from opening day last year in their bullpen. And then the other piece was Bobby Witt Jr. and that $289 million deal that has him here at least for seven more years, possibly 11 and even 14. Those are the kind of deals that are not done in a small market like Kansas City. But I will tell you this, and none of it surprised me. I didn't have the number quite right, but I thought in the offseason, and I said this, that I thought there was a good chance that they would extend him to something, maybe six more years, which buys out a couple of years of free agency, because there was interest on both sides to get this done. But what I had heard leading into the offseason and then throughout the year was that if you could prove to him that you're serious about winning, then he's going to want to be here because this is his kind of place. He's a pretty under the radar, quiet kid, very respectful. But if it just looks like the same old thing, it's not going to happen. So I think spending that $100 million did a couple of things. It makes them on paper very competitive at a time when they're looking to get a new stadium approved. And that vote's coming up April 2nd. And at a time where they're trying to extend and keep long-term, perhaps the best talent that they've seen here since who? I mean, he's got the most skill since, I think, young Carlos Beltran before my time. Maybe the only other comp was Adalberto Mondesi, who could just never stay healthy and hasn't since. But this was the big one. And if you're in a small market and you're going to do this, this is the guy to do it on.
Yeah, you led me perfectly into my next question, because I was going to ask you about sort of where the ballpark effort is. And it did feel like during the offseason, this was a show of good faith from the ownership for the fan base. Look, we're serious. And that's what I thought when they had Bobby Witt Jr., because this felt like to me like it might have been the last window for them to sign him to one of these, long-term deals. Because once you start to get close to free agency, the agents will always recommend you go into the open market. Where do we stand with that effort with the new ballpark? And tell me about some of the reaction you heard in the city when they signed him, because that typically for teams like, Cleveland, like Kansas City, that's always been the biggest challenge to keep their best young players.
Yeah, the Milwaukees, the Kansas City.
Right.
And even the St. Louis, I mean, when you look at them, a lot of the moves they make are oftentimes via trade or going out and, getting that Matt Holiday type. But to be able to keep someone like a Bobby Witt Jr. is not a normal thing here. Keep in mind, too, that all that news came down around the time that the Chiefs were making their Super Bowl run. Nothing else exists in this town when that is going on. Yet, and I think it was Super Bowl week, and I think that news might have come out like early in the week. It was on one of those days where there wasn't as much NFL news, and suddenly for a day, everything shifted from the Chiefs Super Bowl run to what the Royals were doing. And it was on top of already an offseason where people were saying, look, I mean, I could always tell Buster that when I go to the grocery store, how many people want to stop me and ask about the season or not. And it's been more this offseason than I've seen in a long time. There was a stretch, 14 and 15, where that's all anyone talked about in town. Everywhere you went, whether you were a baseball fan or not, that's all that anyone talked about. So we're seeing more of that happen. People are really excited about it. I think, and you know this, not everybody understands the way the contracts work in baseball and free agency and arbitration and all that. So that I think that there are a lot of people here that are programmed to say, we have this great young player, when does he leave? That's
right.
Just for the people that don't understand that you could have them under control for 6 years with arbitration. They think, all right, we get 2 or 3 years and he's going to be gone. And so when suddenly people start thinking, oh my gosh, this guy's here for the next 7 years at least. And you're right. I mean, the longer you wait on this, if he just did 30 and 49 in his sophomore campaign, where is that going? And so I think it all went hand in hand. And the other thing, piece to this too, is that quietly seeing him get comfortable being a leader. He's always going to be a quiet leader. He's going to be more of a Mike Trout personality. For people here in Kansas City, he's going to be more of an Alex Gordon personality. But having been with Alex Gordon almost all of his career, he broke in a little before I got here, one of the best silent, quiet leaders that I've seen. Guys watched what Alex Gordon did. They wanted to do things the way he did them. And that's what I see with Bobby Witt Jr. at a very young age. There's a lot of talk that, hey, he grew up in a baseball family, and so he knows how to do all this. But keep in mind, too, he was born after his father, Bobby Witt, was done playing. But he also had all of his older sisters, he's the baby in the family, all of his older sisters married ballplayers. And so he has been tagging along. James Russell, you remember the pitcher for the Cubs?
Yeah.
That's his brother-in-law. And so he used to get dropped off at Wrigley Field and places like that and just be hanging out in clubhouses all the time like any, baseball kid. So he has been surrounded by this since he was a little kid, and he is now the face of the franchise.
That's awesome. All right, Joel, thanks for doing this. Always great to talk with you.
All right, happy opening day, and looking forward to a fun year. Thanks, Buster.
Baseball Tonight, 2024 team preview. Chicago White Sox, Machinations.
In working to stock their farm system, the White Sox swapped the best available pitcher in the trade market in Dylan Cease to the San Diego Padres. They added Tim Hill and John Brebbia to their bullpen, catcher Martin Maldonado, and they signed Paul DeJong to play shortstop. All of the additions have something in common. Could become trade chips in July. The White Sox struggle as expected.
A guy to watch.
Robert is healthy. His production is gradually catching up to the hype about him. Last year, Robert blasted 38 homers, 36 doubles, and had an adjusted OPS of 128. He stayed relatively healthy, appearing in 145 games. The first time in his career, he reached 100 games in any season.
The weakest link.
Manager Pedro Grifol was not hired by new GM Chris Getz. Last year, the White Sox won 61-101 and had a reputation for having a strangely dysfunctional clubhouse. Grifol may need a good season in his leadership in order to hold on to his job.
Win projection.
Pecota pegs the White Sox with 66.2 wins, while Hembo says 62 and Sarah 61. This is Getz's first full season, and he's not necessarily wed to any player or staffer. If he can make the franchise's future better by swapping veterans at the deadline, he'll do it. So I've got the White Sox going full rebuild this year and winning 58 games. Chuck Garfine handles pre- and post-game show for the Chicago White Sox. He's been in spring training all February and March. Hear from your colleague Len Casper that you have all the dope on the White Sox this year. How you doing, Chuck? Thanks for joining us.
I'm good, Buster. Anything you want to know about the White Sox, bring it on. I'll do my best to formulate my ideas as we get ready for 2024.
Nice. So what was the reaction within the clubhouse to the Dylan Cease trade?
Wow. You know, you knew it was coming at some point, whether it was going to be, well, first it was like, oh, winter meetings. Okay, not winter meetings. All right, January. No. Start of spring training. No. Okay, maybe the trade deadline. And I think midway through spring training, I think a lot of us were thinking, okay, they're going to wait till the trade deadline, because who makes trades of this magnitude in the middle towards the end of spring training? Oh, well, the White Sox did. So I think there wasn't a lot of shock in there because they knew it was coming at some point. And what I was impressed with the White Sox players that I spoke with, they, how easily they turned the page. You know, these guys are, I think, built that way. Their DNA is, all right, well, we knew he was getting traded. Now we don't have the ace of our staff. Turn the page. I'm not going to say they were feeling, oh, we're going to be fine without him, but this is the reality. No Dylan Cease, their best pitcher to start the season. And that was basically the reaction was, there's nothing we can do about it. It's a business. We miss him. We wish he was here, but we have to find a way to have a great season even without Dylan Cease.
So from the outside looking in, it would seem to signal what we're going to see potentially from the White Sox during the year. If they have pieces with value, maybe, you know, they could feed a rebuild. But my question is, you know, having known Jerry Reinsdorf for so long, you know, how long of a rebuild is he in for? Is he basically telling Chris Getz, like, look, if you need to tear it down to the studs, let's do that? Or is this, you know, try to quickly pivot, make a couple moves and get back into the race relatively with Central?
If you go off what Jerry Reinsdorf said when they made the decision, when he made the decision to make Chris Getz the GM, he wants this to be done as quickly as possible. The White Sox already did a massive sell-off before the deadline last season, and you're seeing their farm system go way up in the rankings. But as we know, as the White Sox fans have learned, farm rankings don't mean much because they had one of the top farm systems in baseball after their rebuild, or rather as the rebuild was happening. And what did that do? They got one playoff win during an era that was supposed to be a golden one for the White Sox. So I think you're seeing definitely a retreat this year, salary-wise, even talent-wise, as they're trying to restock the farm system and really bring in a new culture in that clubhouse. You did not, I'm sure you all saw and heard about what was going on in that clubhouse last season. Things went sideways. And so Chris Getz is, you know, for the moment, bringing in high character guys to bring in, to kind of create a, not a winning formula, because I'm not sure how much the White Sox are going to win this year, but they need guys who will hold each other accountable and will be on the same page. And with all the young minor leaguers around them, in spring training, they all were kind of able to feed off of that. And I think that's what this is. This is essentially a bridge year for the White Sox. Make the defense as good as possible to keep them in games. And then next offseason, that's when you're going to start seeing, you know, the moves to make them better, because the AL Central, as we know, is winnable every year, but I'm not sure the White Sox are in position right now to win it in 2024.
Yeah, a lot of times when I hear those stories about clubs, I kind of roll my head. It's probably overstated. Based on the specifics I heard, no, it was bad. Like, it was really bad. And, you know, a lot of it is, you know, the personalities have changed within the clubhouse. Different guys have moved on to other teams. But Pedro Grifol, second year as manager, sort of how is he dealing with that at the same time that, you know, he's working for a guy who didn't hire him?
Well, he does go back with Chris Getz, and that does help because of their time together with the Royals. But you're right, he did not hire him. And if you lose 101 games in a season, I don't know, I don't care who you are, but throw in the fact that he's a first-time manager, he's on the hot seat. I mean, it's just you can't say it any more than that. You lost 101 games. They need results. And what are the results going to be positively for the White Sox this year, for Pedro to be back next year? I can't say, but if, as long as there's progress on the field, progress in the clubhouse, I think that is what the expectations have to be for Pedro Grifol. I don't know what the number for wins it's going to have to be, but I think, you know, he inherited a clubhouse. He said it himself after the season. He inherited a clubhouse that had won a division 2 years prior. Things went off the rails in the first month of the season. He had a choice to make. Does he let the clubhouse kind of police itself, or does he drop the hammer and say, hey, this is unacceptable, this is how we do it here? He decided to let the clubhouse essentially police itself, and we saw what happened as a result. So I think this is more of his team. The players are more of are more buying in with what he is preaching this year, and I think they're going to more reflect the kind of baseball he and Chris Getz wants to see in 2024.
Luis Robert played in more than 100 games for the first time in his career last season. What does he need to do next to continue his evolution?
Okay, Buster, this is the big one for me. I'm watching this. Everyone watch this statistic with Luis Robert Jr. this year. His chase rate was 40%. It was the sixth highest in baseball, and he wants to fix this. I spoke with him about this in spring training. He wants to have this obviously go down. Juan Soto, Mookie Betts, they're at the top in terms of qualified hitters at 16%. They don't chase, and their numbers as a result are much better than Luis Robert's. If Luis Robert Jr. can drop that chase rate into the 30s, maybe even the 20s, imagine what he could do as a hitter, the damage he could do, and he's not going to be swinging, because obviously everyone knows the book on Robert, he's going to chase at pitches out of the zone. If he can limit that, monster season's coming for Luis Robert Jr. If he doesn't, it'll be more of the same, which is still very good, but not top of the echelon, one of the best hitters in the game kind of seasons.
Yeah, it's funny when everyone has their favorite statistic to look at. And for hitters, for me, it's always on base percentage. You know, and he hit all those home runs last year, but I'm looking at a 315 on base percentage. I'm like, man, that it's got to be more in the 340 range before he really begins to, you know, become maybe the threat that everyone has projected him for. So tell me, you know, every camp has young players that catch the eyes of coaches and, you know, managers and players. Who are a couple of those guys for the White Sox this spring?
I got two names for you. Nick Nastrini is one of them. Came over. Actually, both names I'm going to give you came over in the Lance Lynn-Joe Kelly trade. Okay. It is Nick Nastrini, one of the Dodgers' top starting pitching prospects. He was extremely impressive in spring training. And as we tape this, we don't know if he's going to be a part of the starting rotation, but I get the feeling he will be their fifth starter. And the other is Jordan Leisure, who is a closer in the making. Actually, I asked Nick Nastrini, who is this, Jordan Leisure going to be in the future for the White Sox? He says he will be the closer of the future for this team. He was lights out. So, and he will make the team. And I'm not sure where he's going to slide in. I don't know if he's going to be the closer right away. But these are two rookies who came into camp with chances of making the team. And it's looking like both of them will make the team. So that turned out to be a great trade for the White Sox. You had Lynn and you had Kelly on expiring contracts, and you get two pitchers like this who could be a part of the team for a long time in the future.
Chuck, thanks for doing this.
Appreciate it. Anytime, Buster.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hot Ticket is brought to you by Vivid Seats, the official ticketing partner of ESPN. Get great deals and the hottest tickets. Experience it live.
Bleacher Tweets.
Hey, everybody. We got another round of Bleacher Tweets for you today. This first one is from Amy Chapman. And Buster, she asks, you have mentioned that MLB ignored obvious signs of the steroid era and covered up their complicity through the Mitchell Report. Now, with gambling partnerships, is the league in the same position as before with Ohtani as just the more prominent example?
Yeah, and I don't know if Ohtani gambled. I do think that, you know, it took however many hours from when Major League Baseball learned about this. According to our friend Tisha, it was on Monday. We didn't get an announcement and an investigation until Friday. They should have been all over it and announced the investigation immediately. Find out what happened. You know, I mentioned in the podcast the other day, in baseball history, they've always, their biggest problems emerge when they bury their heads in the sand and they don't attack an issue. Steroids, sign stealing. Just come out and just say, look, we're going to do what we can. We're going to full disclosure, you know, because it's not only about doing the right thing, but it's also about protecting the other players. I think they have an obligation to look into this no matter where it leads. And I get it. Ohtani's a really popular player. Major League Baseball is probably cringing that they have to go down this path. But whatever they find, they have to tell people.
And here's our next one from Justin.
Hey, Buster. Justin Simmons from Glenmore, Louisiana. A longtime Bleacher tweeter, first-time caller. And I just had a question. Given how Major League Baseball handled Trevor Bauer, is there any way they're going to be able to avoid suspending Shohei Ohtani until all this gets straightened out and save face and appear as if they're trying to handle everything fairly and even-handedly? It just seems like the way things are mounting up and the way things have been spun, there's a lot of questions that have yet to be answered. And when that situation arose with Bauer, they didn't wait until they had all the answers. They just put him on administrative suspension. So do you think that will ultimately happen to Shohei as well? Thanks. Really enjoy the show.
And Justin, I think the big thing is, first off, we don't know exactly what happened. And I think we need to get more information on that. The other thing, too, is that I think the comparison with Bauer, those apples and oranges, because Bauer was being investigated under the domestic violence policy, and they have something in place to deal with that. Whereas in this case, I don't think they necessarily would be in a position to put him on an administrative leave right away until they answered questions. It's different with a domestic violence policy. But first and foremost, they need to get the information. And I don't know what the information is, and I don't think anybody does. We just know that the interpreter changes story once, and we don't know exactly why that happened and what was behind that. And hopefully we find out soon.
And here's our next one from Ryan.
Hey, Buster. This is Ryan Stensenig, longtime Bleacher tweeter and listener, first-time caller. Originally from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, been living in Fort Myers, Florida for the last 10 years, lifelong Dodger fan. I know you recently just finished your Grapefruit League tour for the year. Just was curious if you had any favorite venues in the Grapefruit League, why that is, and possibly if you have any least favorites, if you're willing to share that. Thanks a lot and keep up the great work.
Well, that's really nice. I appreciate the kind words. I love JetBlue Park. I think the Red Sox Park is awesome. And I got to sit in the monster seats there for the first time, a week ago Friday. And that was a great experience. Any minor or spring training parks where I'd go, boy, that's just terrible. I think generally speaking, in recent years, they've had some upgrades and they've had some good ones. I love going to the Twins Park. Is a little bit older than some of the other ones. That's a really cool place to watch a game. So, but I'd say JetBlue is one of my favorites for sure to go there. And I love the Braves ballpark is excellent, and up in Northport.
That wraps up our Bleacher Tweets for this week, everyone. If you want to leave Buster a message, feel free to mention him on Twitter and hashtag Bleacher Tweets or call us at 406-404-8460.
That's it for today. My thanks to Sean Bartley. Another round of applause, John. Thank you for the work you've been doing. While Taylor's out, way to go.
Thank you.
All right. And my thanks today to Tim, to Sarah, to Chuck, to Joel. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every day. And remember, the TV version of the Baseball Tonight podcast can be seen 2 p.m. Eastern on ESPN2 on March 27th. That's Wednesday, March 27th, 2 p.m. Eastern time.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.